April Council Business Meeting. The agenda's been published for about a month now. Any suggested changes or edits to the agenda as it stands? Okay, I just remind you to turn your ringers off on your cell phones and remind you that roughly every hour and a half or so, I like to take a break, let you stretch your legs and do whatever it is you need to do. Before we get started, I just wanted to make note of and recognize and ask for a moment of silence. We lost two people in the fisheries community that all of you knew. Tom Osmers from the Vineyard passed away after a long battle, some health problems, and Jim O'Malley as well was lost to this world. So I'd just like to ask for a moment of silence. Okay. Moving on to the first agenda item, Council Chairman report. I'm behind tab one, document number one, is the summary of the March 23rd Executive Committee meeting. I hope you've all had a chance to read it. We had a pretty rich agenda for that meeting. We discussed a lot of different topics. Some of them we brought to closure, and others, as you saw as you read the report, are still in development. I'll hit a few highlights from the report, but if you haven't read this summary, I advise you to do so. Be willing to field questions or any other executive committee member, go up to them over the next 3 days if you're not clear about something that I didn't cover or even something that I did cover. The first item we addressed was the Sea Scholar Framework 21 experience, and we were looking for lessons learned. It took probably a good hour worth of the meeting discussion. I think we focused on several things that we learned. One of them was strong desire for species committees to bring forward preferred alternatives for the council to entertain, especially during a final decision meeting. It was felt that was part of the reason why the council went through what it went through concerning Framework 21. So there's a desire to reemphasize to committee chairs that really work your committee hard to bring forward a preferred alternative. We recognize there are times or reasons, and this may have been one, where it's not possible to bring the committee to a place where it's going to recommend a preferred alternative. And in those instances, suggestion from me, and I think the executive committee agreed, that the chair should draft explanation as to what the complicating factors were in not arriving at a preferred alternative, especially for the big decisions within an amendment or an action. We're also at our next executive committee meeting expecting a draft outreach proposal from the executive director. Our next executive committee meeting is slated for June, so we'll have a look at that. But there is a strong belief from the executive committee that the council should be more proactive in how it interacts with the public through an outreach plan. We entertained one of our council members sent a list of items or suggestions on how to address outreach, and those were very informative to the executive committee and also to the staff. I think elements of those suggestions will be contained in the draft outreach plan we're going to receive in June. The next item we discussed were SSC activities. One of the items that fell under that agenda was the ability to have input into terms of reference. While we didn't hardwire in a step-by-step process for TOR development, I did suggest, and I think the staff is going to strive to more widely distribute the terms of reference down through the advisory panels, the committees, Species committees as well, time permitting. We do want to have the broadest level of input we can before those terms of reference go to the SAWSARC process. Again, there's more detail in the report if you want to read it, and feel free to ask questions. Other items under SSC, requirements for meeting attendance, membership, what a quorum is, all of those elements will be addressed at the 10:30 agenda item. Paul Howard has some motions he's going to bring forward for the council to consider. We approved Steve Cadron as the chair of the SSC and J.J. McGuire as the vice chair. We also talked about the SSC's upcoming schedule and trying to balance out some additional work that was put on the SSC. The Pollock assessment is coming up in June. You can read about some of the complications there, but I think we have a way forward. And finally, under SSC, industry member involvement, again, with the TORs and the SAWSARC process, and the NRCC meeting is going to discuss that with the Mid-Atlantic Council as well. And hopefully, whatever comes out of that, we'll discuss at the next executive committee meeting in June. We then received updates on timelines for our management actions and priorities for this year. Scallop Amendment 15 will be delayed until September because of the work and time invested in Framework 21 revisitation. And the Red Crab Amendment 3 is delayed until June so that the PDT can provide information to the SSC for reconsideration of the ABC. There's more details in the report. We also discussed ABCs for Skates and Red Crab. And the service is considering taking emergency action to modify the skate wing possession limit. And as I just stated, the Red Crab decision is being delayed, pushed forward. There's more details there in the report. We also addressed and crafted a policy for a decision matrix on when we would remand a decision to the SSC concerning ABC. Again, the 10:30 agenda item, there'll be a formal recommendation for the council to consider and possibly adopt. I'm going to let Paul bring up NROC. He can give a more full description of what we're getting into there as a council. That's item number 6. Item number 7 was just identifying locations for next year's council meetings. We discussed draft assessment TORs for SARC 51. There was some discussion, just an update on the Maine Fishermen's Forum. Jimmy Odlin requested that the council receive a report on the buyback issues at this meeting, and we do have that on the agenda on Thursday. Item 11 was one of those that we didn't complete, but we're going to finish it hopefully at the June Executive Committee meeting, and that has to do with the scheduling of the TNGC and the SSC. And then we had a discussion on new groundfish sectors. What does it take to bring forward a new groundfish sector? We've received correspondence from several, I believe now more than one, organizations or entities that wish to bring forward a proposal to institute a new groundfish sector. So we're going to get into that discussion of the groundfish portion of the meeting on Thursday. Are there any questions on this report? Again, I just tried to hit some of the highlights. I didn't get into all the details. If you have specific questions, feel free. Jim?
I have more of a comment on the terms of reference, the feedback that we get on the SAWSARC assessments. And I think that the process has improved. We are definitely now, instead of just using standard terms of reference, we are getting those out to the NRCC, and then they distribute the draft terms of reference to their committees and so forth. And we did get quite a bit of feedback for the fall SARC and have been editing the terms of reference. But The comment that I wanted to make is that we can't do everything. So I think that the feedback we got has definitely improved the terms of reference, but the list of terms of reference has grown so much in the last 2 years with the feedback that we've gotten from the SSC that I just wanted to give you a heads up that some of the recommendations that are made will not be accepted. And it's not because they're not good ideas, but we have to limit the number of terms of reference so that we can physically get through the stock assessment review in the week-long meeting. And so I just wanted to make that comment. I think we're improving and we're taking the comments seriously, but there will be a little bit of pushback on our part due to how much we can accomplish.
Paul.
Mr. Chairman, we have an NRCC meeting that we're putting this on the agenda to talk about the process of, you know, right now the TORs are owned by the entire NRCC. It's a process. So we vote on the TORs, but in reality, the Science Center, who is leading the assessment, is the lead in determining, you know, what can and can't be done. But we are going to have a lengthy discussion about a process for approving TORs and how they get approved, so we can bring that back to the council. And that meeting is May 13 and 14 in Baltimore, Maryland.
Mary Beth.
Thank you. Just on this particular issue, I've never been to an NRCC meeting, and my understanding is that it really is to coordinate the activities for the Science Center, which is supporting, you know, multiple management bodies.
You're suggesting you'd like the TORs to be distributed to the council members before they're approved? Paul.
I mean, if we're going to have a process, let's have a good process that talks about how the TORs are developed and what gets finally implemented. So I'm going to ask that we be more inclusive, but that, you know, that process is shared by ASMFC, the Mid-Atlantic Council, the Regional Office, the New England Council, and the Science Center. And it isn't just for science. It's for coordinating all efforts associated with management and science.
Anyone else? Okay. Executive Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll hit on the NROC issue first that you mentioned. As I've mentioned before, there's a Oceans Policy Task Force that recently published its interim report. And the Ocean Policy Task Force and the interim report, two of the largest concerns under ocean policy are ecosystem management, including marine spatial planning. And there is a recommendation in the interim report to have a governance structure. And this governance structure includes a National Oceans Council, a governance advisory committee, which is in Washington, D.C., made up of all national representatives, and then locally or regionally, the state organizations like NROC, which is the Northeast Regional Oceans Council, made up of the governors of the five New England states. And there's another one, the Gulf of Mexico Alliance. There's one on the West Coast. But they're all basically state organizations. Will be in this interim plan, will be the regional body that is part of this ecosystem management. There was, in the interim report and in discussions with NIMS at various national meetings, there was no place at the table for fisheries at this regional level. So all the councils were concerned. I wrote online about two different online comments to the interim report stating that we should be at the table. The national chairmen's, the eight council chairmen signed a letter that said the any act or any executive order that implements this plan should mandate that the councils and the state fishery organizations are at the table at these regional planning efforts. So we want it mandated. But in the meantime, I sent a letter to NROC and said we would like to be members, and we have scheduled them to give us a presentation of what NROC is and where they're going at the June council meeting. Okay. And I've got three other things. U.S.-Canada Steering Committee will be meeting in Halifax May 10th and 11th. The NRCC, as I mentioned, will be meeting in Baltimore, Maryland on May 13th and 14th. And the annual Council Chairman's Meeting will be meeting in Anchorage, Alaska, May 17th to the 21st. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Paul? Okay, moving on. George, you're going to be Pat?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pat will be here later this morning, I think for the remainder of the meeting, but I'll be giving her report for her this morning. As I'm sure you are aware, on March 31st, we filed final rules to implement Amendment 16 to the multi-species FMP, also to implement Framework Adjustment 44, which is the ACLs, to accompany Amendment 16, and the final rule announcing the approval of the sector operations plans. All of those rules were published on April 9th, and all of them will become effective May 1st. To get ready, we have been conducting a number of public meetings up and down the coast, my staff, to inform interested public of the details of the implementation. My staff will also be here at this meeting tomorrow and Thursday, so if you have any specific questions about implementation issues or sector operations, you'll have the opportunity to talk to them if you wish. As of yesterday, we have 778 vessels still signed up for sectors. As you probably remember, they have until the 30th of April to make their final commitment. They can drop out. So as of the 1st of May, we will have the sector rosters locked down, and we'll know exactly who's going to be in which sector. On April 20th, we closed the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder fishery. We projected that 100% of that stock had been reached, harvested, and that will be closed through April 30th. Regarding the groundfish days at sea leasing program, we've processed through April 21st, beginning May 1st, 2009, through April 21st, 711 leases, with the total number of leased days at sea 17,243.63, and an average cost per day at sea leased of $432.66. On Atlantic herring, we have published the proposed 2010 through 2012 herring specifications on April 20th, and the comment period on that rule closes May 20th, 2010. We published the specifications as recommended by this council. At Sea Scallops, we successfully implemented the general category IFQ program on March 1st. There are now 329 IFQ vessels and 40 vessels that have both an IFQ and limited access scallop days at sea permit. In addition, there are 107 Northern Gulf of Maine and 288 incidental catch permits that have been issued. Today, April 27th, we have published the proposed rule for Framework 21 for scallops, and the comment period will run through May 12th on that rule. Spiny dogfish, we published a proposed rule for the specifications for the upcoming fishing year on April 2nd. And the comment period on that proposed rule closes May 3rd. We proposed an annual quota of 12 million pounds and a possession limit of 3,000 pounds. Based on some recent work from the PDT, or the TRAC, there is a possibility that we will be able to make an adjustment in the final specifications that would be in place for the next fishing year. So if you have any comments, please send them to us prior to May 3rd, the end of the comment period on the proposed rule. On monkfish, on March 15th, we published the final rule for a simple regulatory amendment that allows unused monkfish research set-aside days at sea to be carried into the next fishing year. This provides additional flexibility to researchers if they've run into circumstances that didn't allow them to use the days that they had expected to in one fishing year. They can now, beginning in fishing year 2010, roll those days at sea forward to complete their research. On black sea bass, scup, and summer flounder, also today we are publishing the proposed rule for the recreational specifications, and the comment period on that will be open through May 27th. And finally, just for your information, we have prepared and made available to the public for comment a draft environmental impact statement for American lobster, which analyzes proposed alternatives for management of that fishery in the EEZ based on recommendations from the ASMFC in several addenda to Amendment 3 of the Interstate Fishery Management Plan. And that concludes my report. Thank you.
Any questions for Gene? George, Jesus. Sorry, Gene. George. Any questions for George? Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may, just make this is more a comment than a question, because I know Pat attended. There was the recreational fisheries summit held in D.C. 2 weeks ago. Essentially, it was and Frank attended it as well as I attended it. It was a facilitated meeting, essentially an outreach to the recreational fishing industry to get some of their concerns with the service. Interestingly enough, what came out of that meeting, and there will be a summary published of it, are some of the same concerns that are expressed around this table. Better data, better science, and better communication were probably the three key items that came. I just wanted to bring that up, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, George, are you in a position to give us an update as to where NOAA stands with the catch share management policy?
I'm having difficulty hearing you, but I think you asked about the draft catch share policy. Is that correct?
Yes. Where does that stand?
I believe that, Pat will know for sure, but I think that's still open for comment. It hasn't been finalized, I know that. I'm not sure that the comment period closed, but I know that there's been no final report issued, to my knowledge, anyway.
Anyone else? Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Siebel Consulting. Just a quick question for George, I guess. George, you mentioned that there were 778 permits still enrolled in the sectors as of yesterday. Do you have the figures on the vessels who aren't enrolled in the sectors that are in the common pool?
I don't have the exact number, but it's about half.
About half?
About half are in sectors and half are not.
Could you get that number for us at some point in time?
Sure.
All right, thank you.
Dave?
Good morning, Dave Ellington from Western Sea Fishing Company and Cape Seafoods in Gloucester. George, as you advise us, the herring specifications were published for public comment on April the 20th, and the public comment period goes through until sometime in May.
May 20th.
These are the specifications for the fishing seasons 2010, 2011, and 2012. It's taken a long time to get to April the 20th since the council submitted their recommended specifications, and you indicated that those in the Federal Register are exactly the same as the council recommended. Do you think it's going to take as long again to respond to public comments and have final specifications? Because we are continuing to fish under the 2009 specification quantities. We've landed about 50% of the Area 2 fishery. Frankly, I'm not quite sure whether that's 50% of the 2009 quota or the 2010 quota, but it does seem to have taken an extraordinary amount of time to get to the publication in the Federal Register, and I'm just concerned that it may take that long again, and we may be well over the Area 2 landings, because as you know the specifications have been reduced substantially.
I can't say how long it'll take exactly. I know that we'll turn them around as quickly as we can. I think that the reason it took so long to get to the Federal Register is they weren't submitted to us until unusually late this year. So it wasn't an issue of the Federal Register taking any longer than usual or our normal regulatory process. So.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
We'll turn them around as quickly as we can once the comment period closes.
You said that they were submitted to you unusually late. When were they submitted to you?
I don't know the date. My herring people will be here a little bit later this morning. We can talk to them about it.
Gib.
Thank you. Gib Brogan with Oceana. I was doing the math for the Framework 21 proposed rule. Is that a 15-day comment period? Is that
the Framework 21
yeah,
rule?
Yeah, for Framework 21. It seems like a very short period.
It is a 15-day
okay,
comment period, because that rule also is later than it ordinarily would be.
Right.
So we're rushing to get that in place as quickly as we can.
Right. I'm just thinking in consideration of this council's deliberations and re-deliberations of Framework 21, that there may be a need for more careful review and public comment. I know that there's a lot of public interest on this framework, and that a longer comment period, it's already delayed, that another 15 days would probably make a lot of sense. I know the scallop industry was very interested in this. She got it back in front of you folks for a second go-around on this. So rushing it through in the final stage, we'd really like to see it a full 30 days. Thanks very much.
Anyone else for NIMS? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to get back to Paul's report, if that's all right. There was just a question I had on it. Okay. I didn't bring it up at that point because I wanted to go back and dig out this email, and I just found it. I got an email March 30th from people who are doing a project. I'll just read this. To collect information on the fishing industry's awareness and concerns regarding marine spatial planning with an eye toward encouraging a process that will be responsive to user groups such as fisheries, and it will integrate existing management processes such as the council. And that was followed up by a phone call. And I during the phone call, there was one piece of information that came out that I just wanted to share. And that was that these regional councils are going to be created by executive order. And I couldn't hear all of what Paul said, by the way, so if I repeat anything, it's because I couldn't hear it with the way the PA was. But what surprised me was that, first of all, the EO was supposedly going to be issued by the president by the end of April. That I found stunning, that it was going to be done that quickly, because that would indicate to me that there isn't a lot of consideration for fisheries concerns if it was going to be done that quickly. So I don't know if you got any response. I didn't hear the last of what you said to your request. But this person also said to me that I was not going to be happy with the EO, that they were putting the EO together, and he said, you're not going to be happy with it. So I just wanted to let you know that.
Anything further? Okay, thanks, George. Gene?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to report on status of lawsuits involving New England Council actions. We received a favorable decision last week, a couple weeks ago, actually, in connection with the general category Scallop Fishermen versus Department of Commerce case. This is the case that challenged Amendment 11 to the scallop permit that instituted the Limited Access Program and the IFQ program. The court found in favor of the government on all counts in that case. There were three primary issues that were considered by the judge. The first and most predominant was a challenge to the procedure and the substance of the control rule setting the cutoff date for qualifying for a limited access scallop permit and IFQ permit. The court found that the council did not violate any Administrative Procedure Act requirements or council or Madison-Stevens Act requirements in recommending the control date to the National Marine Fisheries Service at the meeting where it did so. The court found that that is not a rulemaking and is not subject to specific APA standards. The court also found that there was general notice in the notice of that particular meeting where the recommendation took place that this would be a type of measure that could come up. And the court eventually found that the opportunity for comment on the control date at the advance notice of proposed rulemaking stage, which is the point at which NIMS actually publishes the control date, was adequate, and that substantively the control date was justified in the record as a necessary measure to address scallop fishing and possibility of increased scallop fishing by the general category fleet. The court also considered a challenge to the establishment of the Northern Gulf of Maine general category fishery that was challenged on National 3 grounds, which requires that a stock be managed throughout its range, and on National Standard 4 grounds, which deals with fairness and equity and also prohibits favoring one state over another in particular measures. And the court found that there was a reasonable record and justification for that provision, that it was considered fair and equitable, that the fact that Maine fishermen may be more advantaged than others because of their geographic proximity to the fishery was not grounds for finding that it favored one state over another. The third general measure that was challenged was the allocation between the general category fleet and the full-time limited access fleet, which the allocation gave 5% of the total fishery to the general category fleet and the rest to the limited access fleet. And that was challenged on National Standard 4 standards again and National Standard 5, which says that a measure cannot be for solely for economic purposes only. And the court found that, again, that there was a reasonable basis for that particular allocation and upheld it. And there is a general claim on all of these measures under the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which says that you cannot take property, basically, without due process and adequate compensation. And the court found that based on precedent, the court did not go into really any detailed discussion of this issue, but based on precedent dealing with whether the curtailing of fishing rights amounts to a taking of property, that in this case, there was not a taking of property. The plaintiffs narrowed their claim to one that said that these vessels that basically did not qualify for a limited access permit, that is, the plaintiff's vessels that did not qualify for a limited access permit, that their scallop gear was no longer usable, and that amounted to a unconstitutional taking. And basing its opinion on precedent dealing with similar matters, the court found that that does not qualify as an unconstitutional taking of property without just compensation. So the bottom line is that Amendment 11 still stands and is considered legally viable. Just a brief update on other cases. We have an outstanding case in Lovgren versus Locke, which is a challenge to the interim groundfish rule that is currently in place until Amendment 16 goes into place. Now, briefs have been filed in that case. The court never called for an oral hearing. It's not made a decision. And so as of May 1st, it is that case will arguably be moot. So we'll see what happens at that point in time. The Western Sea case, which is a challenge to the herring permit splitting provision, has been briefed, and we've actually had three briefings before the court in that case, three oral arguments, I should say, and we are awaiting a decision still in that case. In the Midcoast versus Locke case, which challenged the denial by NIMS of a petition for rulemaking that had asked for closing down groundfish closed areas to midwater trawl vessels. We had an oral hearing in that case before a magistrate and are awaiting his decision. When a case is assigned to a magistrate in federal court, the magistrate is sort of a judge that helps out the main judge in a particular case and will write an opinion recommending that the main judge adopt his findings. And so we are awaiting the decision in that case from the magistrate, and then that decision can be challenged before the main judge in the particular case. Another case is Taylor v. Locke, in which the plaintiffs, which were primarily ground fishermen, challenged the recent rule requiring 100% observer coverage in closed area 1 on midwater trawl vessels. I think, as I've briefed you before, challenge focused on the addition of another exception when an observer is not required to observe a net, and that had to do with the exception stated that the observer does not have to view the net after pumping operations are completed if there are small amounts of fish left in the net or around the net that could not be pumped. And the plaintiffs challenged on a couple of grounds in that case, or actually more than a couple of grounds. They challenged on APA grounds, Administrative Procedure Act grounds, that adding this exception that was not proposed specifically in the proposed rule was not a logical outgrowth of the proposed rule, and therefore the plaintiffs did not have adequate opportunity to comment on that exception. They also challenged the rule because the terms in the exception were vague. It's not clear what small amounts of fish were and what was meant by at the completion of pumping operations. The plaintiffs also challenged, and these came out more in the brief that was recently filed by plaintiffs, the rule on grounds that it violated National Standard 1, National Standard 2 dealing with best scientific information, and National Standard 9 dealing with minimizing bycatch to the extent practicable. And the government's brief is due, I believe, on May 11th in that particular case. There had been a pending case that was basically put on, that was administratively delayed, filed by the Fisherman's Survival Fund with respect to Amendment 11. That challenge was based on the agency's interpretation of Amendment 11 that the interim allocation of scallops to the general category fleet while the IFQ program, or before the IFQ program was instituted, that the allocation of 10% was not supposed to last longer than 2 years if the IFQ program had not been implemented. And that after the second year, that allocation should have been interpreted to go down to 5%. Well, that became moot because the IFQ program has now been implemented, and the plaintiffs in that case have filed to dismiss their challenge. I might also add that there are three so-called class action suits related to the challenge to Amendment 11. And these class action suits, two were filed in New Jersey and one is filed in Maryland, all by the same lawyer that represented the general category fishermen in the challenge to Amendment 11. These lawsuits basically mirror the original complaint in the challenge to Amendment 11, but it's become clear that apparently the plaintiffs in those lawsuits are perhaps challenging the denial of their limited access permits. So that we'll have to see how that develops and allow plaintiffs to more clearly delineate what they're actually challenging. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Gene? Okay. Moving on, Northeast Fisheries Science Center.
Okay. First, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Richard Merrick is here representing the Science Center. He might not be known to some of you. He's the division head of It's called REED. It's the division that does the stock assessments, social sciences, and protected species. Then I'll give the report, and then if Richard would like to add anything, he will. The first, speaking about the ecosystem survey branch and survey issues, with the spring bottom trawl survey, it is underway. It's nearing its completion and will be completed on May the 4th. And it samples from south to north, all the way from North Carolina up through the Gulf of Maine. There is a sweep comparison study that is being done by the center in collaboration with four commercial fishing vessels out of New Bedford and Point Judith. And they're comparing the cookie sweep and the rockhopper sweep, looking at flatfish and skates. There's an outreach education program that the ecosystem survey branch has participated in which they gave a tour of the Bigelow and the center's gear facility and gave detailed explanations and demonstrations of how the survey data are collected. On regarding U.S.-Canada issues, the scientists from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada came down to the Science Center to talk about trawl gear for their surveys. And the Canadians are considering getting the same type of trawl that's used on the Bigelow for its surveys now. And if the Canadians, in fact, do adopt this, then we'll have the consistent sampling equipment all the way through U.S. waters and throughout Canada, which would be good for consistency, and it would also permit opportunities for broader research and ecosystems sorts of questions. One clarification that Wendy Gabriel wanted me to make, after the surveys go out, the center publishes what's called a resource survey report. Some people call it the fisherman's report. And the point that Wendy wanted me to make is that these data are not directly comparable to the data from the albatross. These are raw catches by the Bigelow. And I guess some people are looking at the numbers and comparing them to previous catches and trying to infer something about changes in abundance, and that would not be appropriate use of those reports. So, moving on to stock assessment issues, we completed the SARC 49 in late fall, early winter, which had surf clams and butterfish, and we're just about to embark on SARC 50, which will be the first week of June in Woods Hole. And three big stocks that will be, their assessments will be peer-reviewed: sea scallop, monkfish, and pollock. And SARC 51, which will occur in late November, early December of 2010, will have loligo, as well as three hake species: silver hake, red hake, and offshore hake. The center has also been busy with some track assessments. The dogfish benchmark took place in late January with follow-up on biological reference points at the Science Center and a subsequent evaluation of that by the reviewers. And I can talk a little bit about that in a moment. There was also a mackerel track in the first week of March, and we have the track scheduled for the Georges Bank groundfish. It's Eastern Georges Bank cod, Eastern Georges Bank haddock, and Georges Bank yellowtail. And that's scheduled for July the 19th to the 23rd. We're also doing a bunch of annual assessment updates for the mid-Atlantic stocks, such as summer flounder, scup, etc. And just a word on the dogfish. Dr. Rago did most of those analyses. He gave a report to the Mid-Atlantic Council at their last meeting, and we could offer to have a similar presentation to your council at your next meeting. But essentially, they did define some biological reference points which were sorely needed for quite a while. And then when using the previous model that had been accepted at SARC 43, I believe, in 2006, they did an evaluation of stock status, and the results indicated that the stock is rebuilt. Now, the final paper has not been published yet. That's on Dr. Rago's to-do list, and we're expecting to see that shortly. And that will be followed by a memo from the Science Center to the Council, from the Science Center to Pat Kirkle, indicating the results of the science, and then notification by the regional office to the Council, I presume. But we're working to try to expedite that to get at least the science information finalized and report that to the regional office. That concludes my report. And if Richard would like to follow up.
Just as an additional clarification on the spiny dogfish assessment, there was not a track assessment. The track could not reach agreement on it, and as a result, we're basically continuing, as Jim said, the results from the previous SARC assessment of spiny dogfish. This is probably a topic that will need to come up within the NRCC, what to do next, whether we're going to stay with the track process or pull the dogfish back into the salt SARC process.
Paul Howard.
So, Richard, there was actually a track conducted, a joint assessment, and do you know why it was not accepted?
Yeah, I didn't attend that, but I believe that there was a Canadian model that was developed, and there was a U.S. model, and the scientists from the two countries could not reach an agreement on which assessment model to accept or what's. So basically, they, at that meeting, the Canadian and the U.S. scientists agreed that for the purposes of U.S. management, that they would allow the U.S. scientists to stick with the model which had been approved at the previous SARC and use that for updating our stock status. So using that model and then the additional work that was done after the track on reference points, they reconvened the reviewers from the track, and they are writing reports, but they've essentially approved the work that was done on the biological reference points. So although we haven't stamped and closed the file yet, it appears that all the pieces are in place to complete this stock status evaluation and declare it rebuilt. But as Richard indicated, the track, which was the group that was doing the benchmark stock assessment, did not agree on a model, and they left it kind of open as to when they would reconvene to actually complete their work. And so there isn't another benchmark assessment scheduled for dogfish at this time, and the work is essentially on getting a new benchmark. It's not done.
Richard brings up a good point. I made a note to make sure we bring up dogfish at the NRCC, but kind of to me brings up a broader point, which is, well, I certainly agree with the goal of track or the concepts of having a broad assessment, both nations moving forward with one understanding of stock status and attempting to take that stock status and manage consistently or along the same lines to the same goals. I can't help but wonder how often, it seems to me, more and more often, we're running into similar situations at track where we have Team A with one model and Team B with another model, and we end up with no decision. Seems it's happening more frequently now, and I wonder if I could ask Richard or Jim to prepare us for the NRCC meeting, if he could just quickly look back over the past couple of tracks and see where that's the case and provide that to us at the NRCC.
Yes, but in the case of the most recent track assessments, this herring, mackerel, and dogfish, all those have seemed to be situations just as you described. For the Georges Bank stocks, it's really different. There, everybody seems to be in sync, and they come to the table, and we're able to move ahead quickly. But in some ways, it seems that for some of these other stocks, their heart really isn't in it. But we will be prepared for the NRCC.
Okay. And I think I remember with Yellowtail, and maybe with George's Cod for a period, we had two models presented, and I don't remember all the facts now, but if you could just provide us with a one-pager on sort of the history of modeling at the track and what the outcomes have been, that would be very helpful for our discussion. Thank you. Any other questions for the Science Center? David?
Yeah, this isn't a question. It's actually a promotion based on what Jim said about SARC 51 doing hakes. There's going to be a hake symposium in Portland, Maine on May 11th and 12th. Both Dr. Pierce and myself are on the steering committee for that. We have experts coming from all over the world. It's going to be a cooperative venture. There are a number of fishermen that are scheduled to be on the panels. And one of the things we're hoping to do is provide feedback for the SAR process and identify issues surrounding hakes. And this is the part where I put in a shameless plug and invite everybody to attend, both council members, fishermen, and scientists. There is a fee for some people. For other people, it's waived. You can go on the consortium's website if you're interested in attending and see how it applies to you.
Thanks for that, Dave. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, back to dogfish for a second. The letter that we have before us from Richard Robbins indicates that this is a letter that went to Pat Kirkle, referencing the work and the presentation by Paul Rago recently given to the MID. He indicates in the letter that the track reviewers recently accepted the revised biological reference points. So that is pretty much what you said, Jim. So we are rebuilt. This letter has been sent to Pat regarding the request by the Mid-Atlantic Council that the measures, the quota for the 2010 fishing year that's currently in rulemaking, that quota reflects this information that has been provided by the TRAC biomass reference point, and we are rebuilt. My question is to you, Jim. You indicated that the documents are still on Paul Rago's desk, and he's a busy guy. Would you have any way to give us some indication as to whether or not that particular document and all it implies will actually be made available to Pat Kirkle for her consideration, you know, in the context of this letter that was sent to her by the MID?
Yeah, I spoke with Paul and indicated to him that we would like that to be wrapped up by the end of this month, by the end of April. And he gave me it's essentially complete, which we've all heard before, but I really believe that it is essentially complete. It's a matter of wrapping it up, and we know Paul's very busy, but we're trying to make that happen.
Anything further for the Science Center? Jim Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Civil Consulting. I'd like to make a comment regarding an issue that Jim brought up dealing with the stock survey reports. up the various stock reports comparing the Bigelow against the Albatross at a recent meeting with the governor and the fishing industry in New Bedford. I did do that. Matter of fact, I got the Bigelow's report that particular morning. I took a look at it. Pretty impressed with it, to be honest with you. And while it was a case of comparing apples to oranges, it wasn't meant to, well, I'm not sure what I meant by it, other than to bring out the facts that the Bigelow did do a good job, caught a lot of fish, and in some cases, a lot of fish. And with a new vessel, particularly one you're hoping to be a highline vessel, that's a good thing. One of the bad things I did point out at that time is I think I used the 2007 survey from the Bigelow, which was the one that had no totaling of the final amounts of fish. Every other survey had totaled up at the end of each survey the numbers of fish that were caught. That particular survey hadn't. I had mentioned it to at least Paul Rago, and I'm trying to think of who else was with him at the time. And I thought those numbers were going to be forthcoming at some point. I never received them anyways. And when you're trying to compare and look at various surveys, that makes it pretty difficult. One of the other facts I did point out was, I believe it was that same report, is that there was a dot of pollock in those toes. Very, very little. And it was never summed up. Now, coincidence, maybe. I don't like coincidences, but that's basically some of the numbers that you're using for the reassessment of the survey, from what I understand, a stock report. So that's pretty critical to the industry at this juncture. So that was the purpose for bringing them there. Like I say, I was pretty impressed that the Bigelow didn't have any real faults to my knowledge anyways. And like I say, I think that's a testament not only to the boat and the crew, but to the fishermen that helped get that thing fishing and the gear that's using. And one last point I'd like to make is if Canada does go over to that gear, not only will you be able to compare how the Bigelow fishes against the Albatross in the 40-year history there, you'll be able to look back and see what differences it made in the Canadian fishery as well. So now you basically have two different sums that you can bring together and for comparison purposes. So, like I say, it wasn't intended to degrade the information that's there, but the fact remains is that the industry, with only, 4 days to go, we're still waiting for that pollock report or a reassessment of that pollock survey, and among others, and that's 2007. If the fishermen were that remiss with their reports and their findings and their summaries, they wouldn't be fishing. Thank you.
Anything further for the Science Center? Okay. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Doctor. Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council Liaison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid met in Duck, North Carolina on 4/13 to the 15th. I was there, Terry Stockwell, John was there, and Mary Beth was also there for part of the meeting. The council voted to delay Amendment 11 for the squid, mackerel, butterfish, and one of the reasons was the allocation time and defining historical participants. So that's going to delay that amendment. They're moving ahead with scoping on Amendment 14, which is catch shares in the Lalago and Elex squid fishery. They voted to approve the public hearing document for the omnibus amendment for the ACLs and AMs. And that's for mackerel, squid, butterfish, dogfish, tilefish, summer flounder, scup, sea bass, surf clam, and ocean quahog. After they voted to approve that, I asked the question, aren't dogfish jointly managed with New England? And it was kind of dead silence in the room. And yes, they are. So New England will have to take action after the public hearings, which are going to take place, I believe, in May. So at our June meeting, we'll have to have dogfish on the agenda and approve, disapprove, or whatever to the dogfish section only on that amendment. The Dogfish Committee met. I won't go into details. I think we've already done that. Spent time discussing their RSA workshop and ways to improve the RSA research program, and they're going to update their mission statement to make it a little more clear on the purposes for it. The Council voted to support the ASMFC recommendation for the Black Sea Bass recreational measures, the 3.7 million pound towel, 12.5-inch fish, 25-fish bag limit, and a season of 522-912. They voted to approve the monkfish measures, final measures for Amendment 5. I won't go into too many details because that will be coming up in our discussion on monkfish tomorrow. About it.
Anything further? Erling, would you like to add anything?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frank did a good job. He covered pretty much the meeting. I can't add anything to that. Point of information, Dan Furlong, our executive director, is retiring, and we are now in the process of hiring a new executive director. The Mid-Atlantic Council will meet on the 27th of May to finalize that, and then we will have a new executive director. That's all I have. Thank you.
As Frank pointed out, I did attend the meeting, and it was very nice to sit there and receive the report from Dr. Rago. I know it's preliminary and hasn't been finalized, but the report on spiny dogfish. I remember going back to September 11, 2001, Dr. Pierce and I were in Washington, D.C., or just outside of it, for a dogfish monitoring committee meeting with Dr. Rago, where he told us how bad the news was. And, of course, that paled in comparison to what was really going on that day. But it's nice to know that management has worked, so to speak, and we now are going to be able to enjoy a higher yield on dogfish. So anything further on Mid-Atlantic activities? Any questions? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, regarding mackerel, I'm on the mackerel committee along with, who else? Mary Beth. Yeah, I was unable to make the mid-meeting last week or week before to Duck, North Carolina. However, it's clear from the correspondence that I've seen, announcements from the Mid-Atlantic Council, that much will be happening with regard to mackerel in the next month, next couple of months. And it may be useful, likely would be very useful for this council to spend a bit of time on what is happening with mackerel. They may actually want to take a position relative to Mid-Atlantic Council proposed actions on mackerel. Offhand, I can't recall the timetables and whether the timetables are good for this council in terms of when we next meet, but I at least wanted to bring to your attention, Mr. Chairman, that at least the executive committee should look at this, give it some thought, since there are great implications for the New England mackerel fishery, New England mackerel industry, depending upon the option that is eventually selected by the Mid-Atlantic Council. It is a Mid-Atlantic Council plan, but mackerel landings have shifted in a major way to the New England area in recent years, so we certainly here in New England are major players. We need to pay attention to it. So it's to your attention, Mr. Chairman, and I would ask you for some advice, not today, but at your leisure, regarding how we might want to proceed to have the New England Council weigh in on this very important pelagic issue.
Just to follow up a little bit on some of Dave's concerns there, timing issues, I think, are going to be somewhat tight, so it may be an executive committee discussion. There's been a recent track on mackerel. The stock status is unknown as a result of that. The track recommended that the SSC and council consider capping catch at recent history in the fishery that includes both the U.S. and Canadian catch combined. So in May, there'll be a lot of work done by the Mid-Atlantic with their monitoring committee, an SSC meeting, coming up with an ABC, and then the Mid-Atlantic Council will meet in New York City in June, and I forget the exact dates, but that is prior to our meeting in June. So there is going to be a lot of change going on. The expectation is that the ABC and the resulting OY for the fishery are going to be significant reductions, and to the extent that this council could be paying attention, as Dave said, since we do have a significant industry here in New England, would be appreciated.
Yeah, a question for the Mid-Atlantic liaison on monkfish. And I'm sure we'll get to this afternoon, but can you just tell us a little bit, give us a preview on what the discussion was on the third ACL option? The Monkfish Committee, when it met, was pretty much in agreement almost across the board with this, the one exception of adding a third ACL option as a preferred. So I'm just wondering if you have a recollection of that or what the recommendation was coming back, because that was outstanding and kind of an outlier from the committee meeting.
Yeah, I'll let Frank fill in if I get it wrong. I was at the meeting, and my recollection is that the Mid-Atlantic Council said if the New England Council wants to move forward on option three for the northern area, then that's something they need to decide. But as far as the rest of the document went, they approved the motions that are in the binder. Erling, if you want to add something, or Frank?
Well, this is back to macro point of information. The Mid-Atlantic SAC will meet in Baltimore on May 11 and 12. Mackerel is on the agenda in addition to Surfclim and Ocean Cohort.
Yeah, that was correct. They felt that, it was New England area, so they thought that New England should take, have the vote on that, and they weren't that concerned. But I did ask the question if the Mid would feel the same way, if New England felt differently for the preferred alternative for the southern area, and that really didn't get an answer more than a chuckle.
Anything else? Mid-Atlantic. Dr. Pierce, I'll put some thought into the timeline issues that you and Mary Beth raised, and hopefully we can talk offline about how to best address those. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. And thank you to the staff for getting that up. I'm not sure what the problem was, but you guys resolved it fairly quickly. In the audience this morning, I'd like to point out a couple of folks. Lieutenant Rilla Deischer is sitting here. She's a fixture here, but this is her last council meeting. She's has orders to be the executive officer of Coast Guard Cutter Campbell in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. So she's leaving us, but won't be too far away. And some of you may run into her out on George's Bank as her ship is boarding some fishing vessels. So we wish her fair winds and following seas. And we also have Lieutenant John Lamort and Paid Officer Greg Cadell from the Coast Guard Sector, Long Island Sound Enforcement Staff. So they're here today for some professional development and to see how the sausage gets made as they carry out their assignments of enforcing the regulations. Next slide, please. Okay, the statistics on this slide are from February 1st to April 15th. During the period, the Coast Guard conducted 447 boardings. And during these boardings, we issued 6 fisheries violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 98.5%. During those same 467 boardings, 99 commercial fishing vessels were issued 197 safety violations, resulting in an observed compliance rate of 77.8%. Four safety terminations were also conducted. Two did not have life rafts, and 2 had expired life rafts and unserviceable or insufficient survival suits. Next slide, please. Again, for the period of February 1st to April 15th, we responded to 25 fishing vessel casualties, and the breakdown for those casualties is listed on the slide. And while responding to these casualties, we conducted 4 medical evacuations, and 62 lives were saved. Outside of the reporting period, on the 24th of April, the captain of the fishing vessel Silver Fox was lost after he entered the water to successfully assist one of his crew members who had fallen overboard. He unfortunately perished as a result of what appeared to be a heart attack. Next slide. And looking at preventative measures, there were 296 exams conducted safety exams and 247 safety decals were issued during that same February 1st, April 15th reporting period. One of the more notable instances here was not the decals that were issued, but one that wasn't. The fishing vessel American Heritage received a dockside exam on the 18th of February. And she did not pass her exam for a few reasons. One of them was inadequate fire extinguishers. That issue was corrected on the spot, and during the safety exam, the examiners conducted a significant amount of training in extinguishing engine room fires, which ended up paying significant dividends because on February 21st, they actually experienced an engine room fire on board the vessel. The crew quickly extinguished the fire and were able to sail home under their own power, which is significant. It really points out that the partnership between the vessel owner, the vessel crew, and the safety examiners and how that contributed to a quick and effective response. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer any questions.
Pete, I was wondering, in your first slide, you threw up statistics on safety compliance. One was 77.8%. Is that
right?
How does that rank?
That's about on par with past reporting periods. It generally hovers in the mid 70s. So,
okay.
Most of your safety violations are survival craft issues, pyrotechnics, hydrostatic release, EPIRB issues.
Paul Howard.
Just to that point, Pete, I don't know if the Coast Guard looks at it different, but I look at every safety violation as a significant violation. So what are you doing with getting that up to where the regulations are up at 98%, but safety is 77%, so that's a pretty significant difference.
Absolutely. Not having a fire extinguisher on board is a significant issue. We are continuing our engagement with the industry. We've conducted some training on stability and the upright and watertight series, and we continue our exams, voluntary safety exams, and we're trying to reach a higher level of compliance.
Jenny?
And when you conduct your voluntary safety decal exams, do you record the age of the vessels? And if so, is it possible for us to get a report on the by segment of fleet, maybe by multi-species, by scallopers, on what the age of the vessels are in general, the average age? There's no way to know what the average age of our fleet is other than from you guys.
Paul, can we do that? We can do that. Aggregate age by, you're talking by
but maybe multi-species scallop fisheries.
By permit. By the fisheries they're engaged in.
Right.
We can do something like
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Jimmy, we'll send a letter directly so we can have all the details we're requesting.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right,
you.
If you want to just talk with Paul and I offline. Roddy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On one of your slides, you showed some vessels that applied for dockside examination, and then you had others that didn't, right there. 296 were conducted, and 242 decals were issued. What happened to the ones that didn't get a decal? Did they reapply?
They either reapply, or like the American Heritage, they don't get it, but they'll take some corrective action, and and in that instance, it was very successful. Yeah, the 296, there's some multiple trips in there for folks. But not everyone gets it. You know, it's a partnership. That's why it says partnership up there. It takes two to tango here, and we do our best, but we strongly encourage everyone to come down and get a safety exam. It's got to be both parties here. We can't force you. We don't have the regulations in place to do that, so it really needs to be a partnership. So, again, I encourage everyone to participate. Yes, Rodney.
Yeah, just one other note. We just took 43 EPIRBs out of service because they're no longer serviceable. And we had a promotion with ACR that we upgraded those to a GPS enhanced for a limited time only, that they got a new one for less than the price of a regular one. So, and these were working, but they were no longer serviceable when a battery ran out. You could not put a new battery in them because the company was not going to issue batteries anymore, or if an antenna broke. So we just took 42. And out of those 42, about 75% were not working. They would test where you get the test burst, but they would not send the signal. So we just did that.
And if I could plug the GPS EPIRBs, they give us position right away, as opposed to us getting an uncorrelated EPIRB hit where it could be anywhere in the northern hemisphere or even on planet Earth, and we'd spend a few hours trying to track down where that satellite, until the next satellite pass comes, and maybe we get a more precise location. So the EPIRB registration is also critical in that we can start making calls right away based on who the EPIRB is registered to and find out maybe where the boat is. But the GPS is obviously better.
Okay. I'm going to ask council members to make sure to try to talk as close to the mic as you can. I'm still having trouble, all of us at the top of the table, hearing. I don't know if you guys on the sides are having trouble, too, hearing. But we're going to have to find a way to tune the system up over the day here. Dave Gatel.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to comment on the 77% compliance rate, two of the 447 boardings were me. I passed on both counts, but one of the issues is the number of dates that you have to comply with. I mean, you have, all these dates on all this different equipment, and they're all different. And I think a lot of the compliance issues revolve around people simply being unable to remember when something's expired. A lot of times you have a box of flares, and they'll have three different dates on the three different types of flares in the box. And then you've got the raft, and the EPIRB's got three different dates on it for the hydrostatic release, for the battery, for the registration. All these things, if we could somehow find a way to standardize dates so that on May 1st every year, or whatever date it is on a given vessel, everything expired at the same time so that you knew on that date you had to get a whole bunch of new stuff. Because this piecemeal thing, I think, is what's causing a lot of these compliance issues. Is people just simply forget that my orange flares are expired, but my red ones and my parachutes are still good. Things like that.
Rodney?
Yeah, to that issue, we've taken some proactive action against that, for that. And we've developed a program where we track everybody that does business with us. But I can make it available to David or anybody that wants it. It's a free software. It's easy. You plug in your initial dates, and 5 weeks before it expires, it will notify you if you have a computer. And also, we do put it on a laminated sheet, and we stick it on a piece of plexiglass, and it's right in the wheelhouse. I generally like to put it right in front of the compass, so they look at it every day.
Sounds like a good solution. Anyone else? Okay. Thanks, Pete. NIMS Enforcement and VMS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. Andy Cohen, Office of Law Enforcement. I want to start out discussing the Office of Inspector General report that was issued and OLE's response to that. The first phase of the OIG report was issued, and we are expecting two more. The second one will be a forensic review of the Asset Forfeiture Fund, which is due out within a month, and I understand it's been delayed a little bit. And the third and probably the most important, is the investigation of specific allegations against agents, none of which have been communicated to me specifically. I don't know of any specific allegations against agents. I've read a lot in the newspaper about problems, but nobody has called me and said, this occurred with this individual on this date. So we're looking forward to that report on a number of different levels. The first report has prompted some serious changes within the agency. If you have not read that report, it's online, and I would encourage you to do so. You cannot get a feel for the report from what is being published in the Gloucester Times. The media seems to be reporting on things that have been things that have come up in blogs and editorials, and they are being rewritten as fact. And while someone has said that if you print something 5 or 6 times, it becomes fact, that's really not the truth. So read the report if you're interested, and you're all welcome to call me directly if you want to discuss it. And certainly, if you have suggestions on how we can improve our program, I would welcome a phone call from any of you. The council chair's report, we discussed increased outreach and communications. We too are doing that on a number of levels. In fact, last night we had scheduled a public forum in Gloucester to reach out to the industry and discuss changes and open up communications. That was misrepresented in the press, and the result was that the community decided that was not a good idea. It was our intent was not properly communicated or received. So we have postponed that to a later date. I'd like to do that. I'd like to establish a better dialogue. There's going to be a fisheries enforcement summit in Washington during June. And that was in response. Dr. Lipchenko offered that in response to the OIG report. I do not have details on an agenda yet. However, I do plan on being there and participating. And the current plan is for the other agents in charge around the country in the other 5 divisions to participate also. In response to the OIG report, we're undergoing a workforce management review. We're looking at the ratio of agents to uniformed officers. Separately, but in a related vein, Dr. Lipchenko offered a pilot project in one division for more enforcement officers to be hired for work on the docks. And that is corresponding with Amendment 16 implementation. And I've been cleared to hire 9 additional officers that I'm going to deploy in ports up and down the coast, as far north as Ellsworth, Maine, and down through Marmora, New Jersey, primarily to work with our state partners and the Coast Guard in sector enforcement. Additionally, Alan Reisenhoover, the new interim director of law enforcement, will be at the council chairs meeting, and I expect that he is going to encourage the councils to ask that the law enforcement committees meet more often and perhaps in a new forum and with new members or additional members to facilitate hearing what the industry has to say to us and getting our point across. Regarding Amendment 16 and the implementation of sectors, the whole dynamic of enforcement is going to change in a week or two. What we've done to prepare for that is we've provided training to the Coast Guard and to all of our state partners in how we plan on enforcing sectors. There will be a lot more agents on the docks in the coming months. We're going to be ensuring compliance. We're going to be educating the industry. We're going to be getting a real good feel for how the waymasters are operating. We're going to be looking at the dealers and trying to get a very good handle on the development of how they're going to comply with reporting requirements. I don't anticipate that there are going to be a lot of violations written, especially in the first months of sectors. We're going to be out there learning along with everybody else, and my intent is that we're going to be working with the industry to make this program work. It's a big unknown for us as well as the industry. We're as prepared, I think, as we can be, but when the rubber meets the road, we're going to see what kind of issues come up. So, again, as you hear from your constituents what the problems and solutions are, please communicate it to me or any of my staff. I understand there may have been a problem getting our enforcement report to everybody electronically. So I'm just going to go over a couple of the cases, and if you don't have it already, it will be forthcoming. Last week we got yet another guilty plea in the forever going on catfish cases that I've been telling you about, and this was a fellow in New Jersey who pleaded guilty to falsely importing falsely labeled fish from Vietnam, evading over $60 million in federal dumping tariffs, and selling over $500,000 in mislabeled food from another importer. Sentencing will be within the next several months. A date has not been set, to my knowledge. Just a couple of days ago, the state of Rhode Island boarded a gillnetter in state waters with a state violation of three unmarked gillnets. It was discovered that of the three gillnets, only one of them had a single pinger installed, and in the net were three marine mammals, two dead seals, one live seal. The live seal was released. The dead seals were retained for evidence. The pinger violation and the marine mammal takes are, of course, a federal violation. The Coast Guard is currently putting that case together, and we will review it, forward it for prosecution, and I understand the state is going to address the gillnet issue. The individual charged, or the individual involved who may be charged, is a repeat violator. He's been a very vocal critic of our program, so the irony of him getting caught again right after making so many complaints about us does not go unnoticed. Also, late last week, agents in Bellport, New York, boarded a scallop vessel and found yet another hidden compartment built into the vessel, concealed on the transom, very cleverly disguised with a quantity of scallops in there. That is being that was discovered dockside, and we're currently putting together a case package on that. And during this reporting period, the Observer program reported gave us 14 complaints. A couple of Observer refusals, one Observer harassment, one interference, two interference issues, five safety issues, and two program notification issues. There were no gear complaints. Of those 14, several of them are still open investigations. None of those have been referred to general counsel at this point. And with the exception of two of those, I don't anticipate that there will be any charges. That concludes my portion of the report, and Bill Semereau will tell you about vessel monitoring.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and council members. Can you hear me okay, John? Okay. All right. I'm Bill Semereau, the Northeast VMS Program Manager. The Northeast VMS team is currently monitoring 1,350 Northeast permitted vessels. That's broken down by 680 with Botrax units, 631 with SkyMate units, and 39 with Tron units. As of March 14th, the National VMS Program Manager, John Pinkerton, has left NOAA Fisheries Service to work for another government agency. His deputy, Kelly Spaulding, is currently the acting National Manager until a replacement is identified. Kelly is reporting directly to Alan Reisenhoover, the acting OLE Director. The majority of my time this quarter has been on preparations for Ground Fish Amendment 16, On March 30th, the Northeast Region sent a letter to all multi-species permit holders providing VMS information for this regulatory action. It's about a 30-page letter. It's actually 7 pages with 23 pages of enclosures showing the various vendor software screens that are being changed. As stated in the letter, Amendment 16 has been approved under the VMS reimbursement program for vessel owners who purchase a VMS in order to comply with the requirements of Amendment 16. And additional VMS information pertaining to Amendment 16 is being posted on our VMS webpage, and that's available through the NERO website. Just go to the fishing industry homepage. We've been working collaboratively with each of the VMS vendors as they develop the new vessel-side software to meet the A16 reporting requirements. SkyMate was the first to finish their software development and testing, and they really did a great job on that. I had very few changes for what was a pretty complex software rollout. On April 20th, following our own testing, we approved the release of their software. SkyMate mailed software disks with the latest version, which is 3.934, to all Northeast customers last week. And when a fisherman loads that software, they'll see that version number up in the left-hand upper left-hand corner of their screen, 3.934. For those that are tech-savvy, the software can be downloaded directly from SkyMate's website, burned to a disk, and you can install it yourself without waiting for the disk to get there in the mail. BoatTrax completed their macro development and testing, and they were approved for release on April 26th. BoatTrax will provide the new macros to their Northeast customers via an over-the-air update on the morning of April the 30th. Owner-operators will automatically receive the new macros the next time their terminal communicates with Qualcomm, the satellite service for BoatTrax. The macros will download. Those new macros can be identified as Activity Reports version 12 and Forms version 6. Finally, GMPCS, which provides the Tron software, they're expected to have their software ready. Actually, it's ready. I just got the software today, and we're testing that. It's a little bit late for testing, but we're doing the best we can to work through the testing and make sure they've got a good product. So far, it looks very good. Two windows for over-the-air updates for the Tron software have been scheduled for April 29th and April 30th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And VMS vessels running Tron units are being reminded they have to have the units powered up and the software running in order to receive the download during one of those scheduled windows. Owners can identify the new software as Trip Declaration version 8.0 and Reports version 6.0. And those new software versions for those three vendors are in the VMS permit holder letter that was sent out the end of March. All Northeast vessels must be running the new software for any trips taken on or after May 1. Vessel owners who do not receive the new software before May 1 or experience a problem should contact their vendor for assistance. The Northeast VMS team is ready to assist any owner-operators with their new reporting requirements, and we'll do our part to ensure a successful implementation. On April 2nd, Pat Kirkle authorized an open port configuration on a voluntary basis for groundfish sector vessels using the BoatTrax VMS. BoatTrax units are normally in a closed configuration, but their port, the serial port, can be enabled through an over-the-air command. The regional administrator allowed the open port in order for owner-operators to meet sector reporting requirements through the use of third-party software. In this situation, the VMS satellite network is used to transmit the third-party data, and there is no impact on the transmission of VMS data. As for the other Northeast VMS vendors, the currently approved SkyMate unit has an open configuration and can support third-party software. The Tron unit, however, is a closed configuration, and it, as configured, it currently cannot interface with third-party software. And due to differing type approval requirements, vessels with dual Northeast-Southeast permits, and there's roughly 30, will not be able to run third-party software for the near future. So Tron and dual reporting vessels will have to use alternative reporting methods to meet their sector reporting requirements. In order to ensure that VMS requirements are understood and issues are quickly communicated and resolved, I intend to maintain regular communications with the sector managers. So I've got a distribution list I've created where I could send out communications about VMS to the 17 or so sector managers, and I've already started that outreach as of last week. And, Mr. Chairman, that completes my brief. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Start with Mary Beth, then Terry, then Rodney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a question for Andy and for Paul, but just first for Andy, some clarification. I think you said that Alan Reisenhoover was recommending that the enforcement committee meet more often, and I'm assuming you're referencing our enforcement committee in which you participate on?
That's correct.
And just so to follow up on that, I was just wondering, what is our current schedule for the enforcement committee to meet? I mean, do they only meet when we have, like, final review of an action? I was just a little uncertain how we could translate that recommendation into some kind of action here at the council.
That's funny you mentioned that. I just mentioned to John that we ought to reconstitute and make NEMS and the Coast Guard chair, vice chair, have two council members and two AP members and two state enforcement officers on it, and allow them to meet six times like every other committee. So we'll be beefing that up right away.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, observer complaints are starting to become a pretty regular component of your reports, and 14 of them certainly raises my eyebrows, out of which you said there were two refusals and one harassment. But you said out of the 14, you're only going to move ahead with two actions. That means there's 12 of them that were they unfounded? Is there a problem with the industry, or is there a problem with the observer program? And so that, you know, certainly as we segue into better monitoring and Amendment 16, we've got to get the industry on board. And if the observers aren't coming across in a professional manner, then I think we need, you know, I'm sorry that Amy's not here, but I think we need to have a broader discussion.
Do you have the enforcement report? Has that, okay, when you get it, you will see a breakdown of each incident. Most of them were closed with either a verbal warning or a fix-it kind of approach, an educational kind of approach. Remember that it's still fairly recent that I started reporting on these with numbers. So while the numbers may look high, don't take that as a trend. In fact, I think the trend is improving. I think that we're having less issues. Certainly, the number of referrals to general counsel has gone down in the last year. I sense that we've had an agent co-located with the observer program for 3 years now, and over those 3 years, he's built a very good daily working relationship being co-located with them. So a lot of the issues that have come up that became problems in the past are now issues that result in quick solutions, which is really the best way to do it.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you. My question is for Andy. You said that you'd found a scalloper with a hidden compartment. Was that a general category or a limited access one?
I don't know. I can find out.
Dave?
Actually, I have two comments. One's for Andy. On the fixed gear issue, I would suggest it'd be a good idea to perhaps send a letter to all fixed gear fishermen, both lobster traps and gillnets and hooks and slime eel, everything, as to what the gear marking requirements are. There is consistently, for a number of different reasons, people that are not marking gear correctly. I brought it up with the people who boarded me both times I got boarded. This issue is ongoing and continuous in the Gulf of Maine, and there are, you know, there's a number of reasons for it. Some are cost related, some are legal issues. You know, people don't want you to know where their gear is. They don't want their competitors to know where their gear is. But I think it would be a good idea to educate people, and then you know, perhaps move out there and really start aggressively enforcing this, because it's a major problem. You can't go around stuff you can't see. And the second one is a question for Bill. Have you done any testing, Bill, on you know, kind of powering up this system for what's going to happen May 1st when all these extra transmissions start, to see if it's going to work? I mean, I'm in the study fleet. I send these vessel hails to the study fleet, and only about 25% of them successfully go through. And I'm really concerned that when a whole bunch of these trip hail end things hit that satellite, that the whole thing's just going to go poof. And I don't know what happens when the electrons stop communicating with each other, but you know, if it goes poof up in the sky, nothing comes back to the ground.
Yeah, that's a good question, Dave. I will say that you know, the VMS transmissions are actually a fairly small amount of the traffic that the satellite providers handle. I can only really guess that, you know, the additional transmissions aren't really going to have that much of an effect, although I think you'll still see the usual latency that you see in the, you know, the Orbcom network, which is what SkyMate uses. I don't think certainly not going to go away. As far as the third-party software, you know, no, I haven't done any testing with that. None of those reports are required, you know, in the VMS program. The hail reports can be sent through VMS, but, you know, that is optional, as you know. They can also be done via, you know, other methods, whether it's third-party, radio, phone, whatever your sector op plan calls for. I do have some concerns that if, you know, when that third-party data starts going, whether it's going to slow down any of the VMS transmissions. I guess that is yet to be seen. I don't know yet. Yeah.
Anything further?
I'd just like to respond to Dave's question. Thanks for bringing that up. That's an important point. We're aware that there's some confusion over those regulations, and that will be part of what we look into when we examine this incident. However, I failed to mention that a permit holder letter was issued late last week or is in the process of being mailed this week. I'm not exactly sure. Re-explaining the requirements and the exemptions and the exceptions and the areas. And which brings me full circle, and I know I'm like a broken record. When regulations are promulgated, they've got to be easy to follow. I know that I'm really simplifying things. I know that there are a lot of factors involved. But when you have an exception and an exemption, and it's the second Thursday of the fourth full moon, it makes it really tough for people to comply, and it makes it really tough for us to identify a violation and not get people spun up when we identify an alleged violation, which turns out not to be one. That doesn't help anybody.
That's excellent. I'm really glad to hear that. I left home yesterday. I hadn't got the letter yet, but I think that's necessary. I think we always need to remind people of what the law is, but then when they still continue to ignore it, that's when you got to start taking action. Thank you.
Paul Howard.
In the international imports of mislabeled fish certainly can disadvantage our fishermen and the economics of our nation, and so your efforts in those regards are good. However, I'm concerned about, it seems to me, I'd like to know if they're increasing, and are you getting additional resources to address those international concerns? And if not, you know, maybe there's something we could do, but it just seems to me there's an awful lot of presentations about Vietnam, Chilean sea bass, South America, all this kind of stuff, and we want to make sure you have enough resources that don't take away from domestic enforcement as well.
We have gotten some more international resources in the last year. They've all been at headquarters. I have not seen any additional support to the field yet. I'm told it will be coming, but I haven't seen it yet. I can safely say that I can take all the agents who I work with and put them on these illegal import issues, and there'd be enough work to go around. Of course, I can't do that because I've got it's a balancing act. As far as a trend, I don't have hard numbers on if the trend is increasing, but I've been told from the Southeast Fisheries, Bob Jones, I forgot the name of his outfit, Bob has crunched some numbers, and he has told me that it's increasing and that the amount of mislabeled fish, specifically in the Southeast, is overwhelming. I have no reason to believe that it's different in the Southeast than the Northeast. I know that I see an awful lot of mislabeled fish in markets and restaurants, and I'm no expert. I'm just maybe slightly ahead of the average consumer, but I think it's a real problem, and I think it's a real issue. You know, we're importing over 80% of seafood. That's impacting our local economies. It's impacting our communities, and I've said this before, I see aquaculture as having a real impact on mislabeling. I think that there are people who can try to exploit those products, and that will also undermine local businesses. So I think the enforcement needs to be vigorous. It's a difficult thing to enforce. It's very time-consuming. It certainly is not on the top of our priority list when it comes to protecting local businesses and local ecosystems, but it's important. And if you can influence in any way encouraging the other enforcement components to address that, I'd support that.
Anything further? Jim?
Thank you. Jim Kendall again. Actually, I had the same question that Rodney brought up about the identification of the scallop. I would ask that in cases that involve scallops like this, that we differentiate between the limited access and general category. While it's the same species, it's actually different fisheries, so people would tend to assume that it's going to be a limited access just based on the number of preponderance of limited access boats. So I'd like to have that identified if possible. Another law enforcement concern I'd like to comment on was recently at the congressional hearing up in Gloucester. The question came up about law enforcement working groups. And I've been a proponent of that ever since I served on the first one and actually had the privilege to be the chairman of it. It fell by the wayside over a period of years, but I think it was a really good working relationship afforded between the industry and law enforcement and all branches of law enforcement, Coast Guard, enforcement, state, the works. And I think it provided everyone a chance to speak outside of the normal routines or places. So I was encouraging that be reconsidered. Since then, I found, while looking through the Magnuson Act, the latest revision of the Magnuson Act, it actually states in there that the 1st Coast Guard District will form another law enforcement working group. So I would encourage both Captain DeCola and Special Agent Cohen to see what the holdup on that is and try and give me some, at least myself, if not the full council, if they don't have any interest, an understanding of where we are with that. And with respect to imported fish, I have done quite a bit of seafood inspections over the last 15 years, and I think you might find, and this is only my opinion on this, and I've been wrong before and chances are I'll be wrong again, but one of the reasons I think you're seeing so much of this, and I think a preponderance of that also will come in from the Gulf of Mexico fisheries and so forth, is the similarity in the fish. The flesh of the fish oftentimes allows people to substitute something that they shouldn't be substituting. With cod and haddock and fish that you know up here, it's a little more difficult to supplement with something that doesn't resemble it, at least. Much like the old saw that people were cutting skates for scallops. I mean, once that stuff gets started, you just can't change it unless you know what you're talking about when it comes to the flesh of the fish. So I think New England is relatively safe on some of that stuff, but once again, that's just an observance of my own. Thank you.
Okay, anything further? Thank you, gentlemen. Vince, ASMFC.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I know you want to get through these sections, so I'll try to be brief. The commission met in February, and a summary of our winter meeting report is in your briefing books, and thank you to Captain Howard for including that for me. And one of the issues there was New Jersey was found out of compliance for failure to implement the Coastal Shark Plan, and they're currently working with the Secretary of Commerce to resolve that. Gene Martin gave you an update on lawsuits. Most of you probably know that we've been engaged with a series of suits involving summer flounder or fluke. One, though, of particular interest involves a novel argument that the ASMFC is a quasi-federal agency, and because of that, it has impacts on the types of lawsuits that can be brought against the commission. We obviously don't agree that we're a quasi-federal agency. We're in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals with that case. We had oral arguments in March, and we're waiting for a decision. Gene mentioned three lawsuits in the general category, scallop permit Amendment 11 issue against the Secretary. We also were named in three of those cases for our contribution to the landings data. Suit was brought against ASMFC and the ACCSP. Those three cases were terminated in late February. And on Thursday, I was served notice with a fourth lawsuit from the same attorney that did the general category ones. This one is in the situation of the Mid-Atlantic plan for tilefish, and the plaintiff, again, is seeking relief for their entitled and unknown landings of tilefish. And, again, the argument is that the data was some data was in ACCSP, and ASMFC provides office space for them. Our next meeting, Mr. Chairman, is next week in Alexandria, Virginia. We've had to make a number of schedule changes since our first announcement, so I just remind people to look carefully at the schedule. The one that's in your briefing book is the current one, and some of the items that I think will be of interest of action on lobsters, herring, striped bass, weak fish, and we're going to get a stock assessment on menhaden as well. That concludes my report, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Vince. Further comments on ASMFC activities, just keep in mind we're already running behind, so if it's important for New England Council to know about, Dr. Pierce.
Just a couple of additions quickly. The Lobster Board did meet. A lot of discussion about reference points to be considered. Technical Committee is working on some considerations now, some proposals, and next week I believe there may be some decision to adopt some particular reference points for Georges Bank, Gulf of Maine, and elsewhere. I only mention this because we are about on May 1 to go into very unknown territory, Amendment 16 implementation, and clearly there will be some effort shifts between fisheries, possibly increased effort within the lobster fishery by trawl vessels in response to low ACLs for groundfish and, of course, lobster availability. So Doug Brout is the vice chair of the Lobster Board, so we are in a position, therefore, I suspect, through Doug and also other council members to try to keep track of the effort shift that likely will occur and the impact on ASMFC management for lobster, of course, the services involved in lobster management as well in the EEZ. Sea herring, we did adopt the same specifications as the New England Council did, so we're on the same page. That makes a great deal of sense. A little later on, we're going to be discussing under herring that which will be also discussed in a more significant way relative to small mesh fishing for sea herring in Area 1A and merits of that, drawbacks and merits of that. Dogfish, we did adopt a 15-million-pound quota that actually was a quota less than what the New England Council didn't say but kind of directed us to go with, and that is a fishing mortality rate of 0.2 corresponds to landings of about 19 million pounds by the U.S. fishery. So we were very conservative, an increase from the 12 up to 15 million, and now we'll see what the service does with the increased information regarding status of the stocks that as are being rebuilt. And then finally, this is a real important one. This relates to the policy board next week is going to be meeting to discuss how the commission should respond to the Mid-Atlantic and New England Fishery Management Council actions on annual catch limits and accountability measures. The board has tasked staff with summarizing the actions being taken by the councils for presentation at the spring meeting, that is, next week. Then the individual species management boards will individually decide appropriate ASMFC action. For this council, it's not as significant. Obviously, sea herring, we're on the same page with sea herring. But with Mid-Atlantic species, it takes on far greater importance, fluke, scup, sea bass, and what will ASMFC do relative to what the Mid-Atlantic Council is considering through its omnibus action on ACLs, accountability measures, and the like. There actually is going to be a public hearing at the ASMFC meeting to discuss those issues. Spiny dogfish, Frank's already highlighted that. This council will get back involved in those discussions, I suspect, to see where, indeed, the Mid-Atlantic Council would like to bring us. So that'll be an extremely important public hearing, we'll now see in the next few months where ASMFC is relative to council actions on ACLs, AMs that are specific to National Standard Number 1 guidelines and not really to the Magnuson Act itself.
Anything further, ASMFC? Thanks, Vince. Thank you, Dr. Pierce. I'm going to move quickly through the next agenda item, then we'll take a break. The review of experimental fishery permit applicational, 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 fishery